I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Historically, suicide rates for Cape Cod and the islands, adults have been nearly 1.5 times higher than the state average and 2.5 times higher for Cape teens. Local organizations, healthcare providers, and concerned citizens have stepped up efforts to raise awareness about suicide and better educate the public on prevention strategies. Joining us in our studio is Lisa Forehand. She's the Director of Risk Management at the Massachusetts Department of Mental Health and co-chair of the Cape and Islands Suicide Prevention Coalition. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Also in studio is John Murray, along with Maria Ventura. He founded Darkness Into the Vineyard Light to raise awareness about suicide and encourage people to talk more openly about mental health. Welcome to you, John.
Thank you for having us.
And on the phone is Melissa McGuire, the other co-chair of the Suicide Prevention Coalition. She's a director of student services in the Monomoy Regional School District. She joins us on the phone. Hi, Melissa.
Good morning.
All right, so Lisa, we'll start with, for a time, the Cape and Island rates of death by suicide was 1.5 times greater than the state average. Are we still seeing higher rates in our region, and do we know why the Cape and Islands had that higher rate?
We are, and we do know that anecdotally, not unlike the western part of the state, there is a lot of seasonal economy. There are a lot of the demographic is pretty much the same, that we are very concerned about middle-aged trades workers, primarily white men. They really make up the largest number of suicides on the Cape and the islands. And we do think that work dries up in the winter. We think that substance abuse goes up in the winter, which reduces people's inhibitions. And so, again, like the western part of the state, the Cape Cod and Islands are particularly vulnerable to those risk factors.
And we should mention that even though the Cape and Islands rate is higher than the state number, Massachusetts has a relatively low rate of suicide when you compare it to the rest of the country, right? So we have to put this all in perspective.
That's true. Yeah. And why we would like to see the number be zero. Mm-hmm. Any suicide is too many. The state of Massachusetts does put robust funding into suicide prevention, such as partially funding some of our coalitions. So we are able to do some messaging, do some education and training, and we hope that that's having an impact.
Mm. All right, so we're going to change directions here for a second. People feeling desperate or having suicidal thoughts often turn to the 24-hour crisis hotlines. People trained specifically to respond to those in crisis will stay on the phone for as long as needed. And last week it was reported calls to our local crisis hotline run by the Samaritans went unanswered. Joining us on the phone is Stephanie Kelly. She's the executive director of Samaritans of Cape Cod and the Islands. Good morning, Stephanie.
Good morning, Mindy. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
You bet. Stephanie, the Cape Cod Times ran a story last week that outlined several instances when calls to the Samaritans hotline went unanswered. Were you aware this was happening, and what was the reason the calls weren't being answered?
No, I wasn't aware of the technical issues that we were having. It was unfortunately kind of a perfect storm, and one of our crisis lines, the statewide line that is forwarded down to us by Boston, when they have the Boston Samaritans, when they have an overload, that one was the one that was having the issue. And unfortunately, people were getting a message that said it was out of service, the worst possible message.
Right.
We didn't know that until it was brought to our attention. So I'm not quite sure if it was a couple of days or a couple of hours. I just don't know. But that's been rectified. And then we have the other issue that I think Cindy McCormick brought up, is that we are really in need of volunteers. Currently, on average, we really usually only have one volunteer on per shift. And it's always been our policy that when we are on a call with a caller that we think might be at a higher risk level, that we don't abruptly leave that call to check another call that's coming in. Obviously, if we had two volunteers on, we'd be able to handle that segue a lot easier. I think that one of the misconceptions about what we do is that we answer every call that we answer is an actively suicidal person.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not really the case. Most of the people that call us are people, I'd like to think we're catching upstream. They're people who are lonely, or they're desperate, or maybe they are thinking about suicide, but not actively planning it right that moment.
Right.
So what we do is we provide a connection to them to try to keep them from going downstream and getting to that point where they see no other alternative. So, I think that there's a community misconception about what we do, what our volunteers do, and who they are. They're people just like you and me. They don't have to be have their PhD in psychology.
Right.
That's not what we do. We're not clinicians. We're listeners.
Listeners, yeah. So, what are the peak hours for calls to the hotline, and how many staff is ideal?
Two mm-hmm. volunteers on would make a world of difference. I think three is better, but, you know, we would be happy with two volunteers on. It's hard to say when peak hours are, because right when I think I have it figured out,
it changes.
It fluctuates. Mm-hmm. I think Monday mornings are particularly busy. Mm-hmm. The evening hours that we would assume would be busy from 6 to 10:30 when we're there in the evening is not as busy. I think it gets... I think people start to struggle more and need more of a connection later at night. Mm. So I would say probably, you know, after our hours, after we are kind of done with our business day or whatever.
You know, Monday makes so much sense, doesn't it? Doesn't everybody feel a little down on Monday to begin with, right?
Yeah. And like every professional office, we're waiting all weekend to call our doctor or the dentist or whatever. So in some respects, there are people, even though we have coverage on the weekend, I think there are some people that just need that extra support on the morning just to start that.
So how long does it take to train volunteers to staff the hotline? And have you seen an uptick in people stepping up to become trained volunteers since that story ran in the Times?
Yes, I have, and I can't tell you how much that warms my heart. We've had volunteers that have taken some time off that have come back, and we've had so many inquiries that we're actually planning a training the latter part of October. The training involves 18 hours of in-class instruction, and we try to vary that. We do it in the evening for people who work during the day. We'll do it on weekends, whatever works for everyone's schedule. And after that, once they're trained in the classroom, then they have some shadow shifts or observation shifts with veteran volunteers on the line until they feel comfortable with doing it on their own.
Now, people listening might want to help but think, I wouldn't know what to say to someone in crisis. And you're mentioning what's happening in the training, and you cover that. And as you mentioned, you're really more listeners, right? So you, people shouldn't be intimidated by they wouldn't know what to say, right?
Exactly. Ideally, we don't need to say a whole lot. What we need to do is listen. And, you know, since we're not fixers, even though human beings want to be that, it's not really our job, or more importantly, it's not what the callers really want or need as far as like information, referrals, and that perfect statement to come out of your mouth. What they need is to know that they're being heard, know that you're really listening, and know that you're kind of, for that short period of time, you're helping them bear that pain that they're in. So really what a volunteer needs is a good heart. Mm-hmm. And the ability to be empathetic and be willing to be in that place with that person and let them feel what they need to feel and support them while they feel that.
Yeah, because just knowing that somebody cares on the other, as you're saying. We'll post a link with more information about the Samaritans of Cape Cod and the Islands and how to volunteer for the Samaritans at our website, capeandislands.org. Stephanie Kelly, thanks so much for taking time to speak with us.
Oh, Mindy, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
And since we're talking about crisis hotlines, we should mention that the Cape and Islands Suicide Prevention Coalition website has several crisis phone numbers listed, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, as well as support lines for youth, veterans, LGBTQ youth, and we'll put a link with those other numbers at our website, capeandislands.org. So, Lisa, what is your advice for people who call a crisis line and they don't get access? In this case, it was a technical problem, but I'm sure that happens with other lines as well. So what's your advice if somebody's trying to call and they're running into that kind of problem?
There are a number of ways that people can access help when they're having a mental health crisis. First and foremost, you can always call 911. If you're really feeling desperate and in despair, calling 911 is perfectly reasonable. There are also crisis teams that are working across the state. There's a statewide number as well as local numbers. We have local mobile crisis services on Cape Cod and the Islands as well. So we try as much as we can to put that information out. It's certainly on our website, and you can just do a general Google search and you can come up with a phone number to contact and have someone. You don't necessarily need to go to the emergency department. Mm-hmm. You can actually have someone come to you and do an assessment if you need that in your own home.
John, for a long time, talking about suicide was taboo in our society, and this is slowly changing. Tell us about Darkness into Vineyard Light and where this idea came from and why raising awareness about suicide and mental health is so important to you.
Well, I've on Martha's Vineyard, where we started Darkness into Vineyard Light, I was observing a lot of families and friends that were suffering, and we would hear of another suicide, we were like, what can we do about this? So I was born and raised in Ireland, and I go back frequently. I go back every year to see my family, and they have an event over there that they started 11 years ago with 400 people at 4 a.m. in the morning to do a walk to raise awareness to mental issues and suicide prevention. And that event has taken off to 220 different locations throughout the country. Last year, it was over 250,000 people who took part at the same time. Every morning, on the same day, every year they started. So I brought it back to the island and went to Martha's Vineyard Community Services, asked us if they were interested, and they put me in contact with Maria Ventura. Mm-hmm. And we formed a little group of citizens and we started this walk. Last year was our first year. It was amazing. We expected about 60 to 80 people. Over 200 showed up at 5 a.m. in the morning. And we started at the bend in the road in Egertown, and we went up to the bridge. And we, as the sun started coming back, it was a really emotional moment. And then we have breakfast on the beach and socialize and talk about their experiences.
Yeah. Right. Let's look to Scott, who's giving us a call from Bourne. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Mindy. How's everyone doing today?
Great.
Excellent. So, yeah, so I'm just so glad to hear this topic, and I really want to thank the guests for being so willing to talk about these issues and the incredible number of hours that you've all put in because you've been personally affected, as we all have, by suicide. And I also work with Thrive in Hyannis, which is the LGBTQ mm-hmm. and Ally Youth Center. And, you know, what we learned through this work over the last 15 years or more is that when we talk about suicide, it actually doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. And yet, I think as individuals, when someone comes to talk to us about it, we are so scared to bring it up because we're afraid they're going to say that they're thinking of making an attempt. And then we're thinking we won't know what to say. But the best thing we can just do is to say, you know what, I don't have answers. I'm so glad you're trusting me. And, hopefully, if we keep talking, you can feel a little better. Mm-hmm. Things are hard, and I'm listening. So I think what's amazing is it's sort of counterintuitive what's so successful with helping people and being present. It's the isolation that really makes it hard for folks.
Yeah. Actually, this is Scott Fitzmaurice. Scott, I didn't know it was you until you started talking, but I'm so glad you brought that up. And Lisa is nodding her head. And that was funny because that was my next question for Lisa is about this talking about it, that, you know, we think that that's planting the seeds for them to consider suicide. And there's no evidence to support that. Right, Lisa?
That's right. Scott, are you QPR trained?
I am.
Nice.
Okay, I'm trained in different methods, but yeah.
Okay. Okay, you need to tell listeners what that is.
So QPR is a training that sounds like CPR on purpose. Mm-hmm. It's called, it means question, persuade, and refer. QPR is a training that we offer with the coalition, and the idea is to train people that are not clinicians, but to train everyone the way that we want everyone to be trained in CPR to be able to respond and know the signs of someone possibly having thoughts of suicide. What is exactly correct about what Scott said is that we know that so often people that are contemplating suicide may be thinking, I wish someone would ask. Mm-hmm. And it's completely a myth that bringing it up to someone who you might feel is in despair would be giving them the idea. That's really not true. And in fact, you can save their life by just asking the question.
Yeah. I want to bring Melissa into this conversation. Melissa, you do this training with the folks you work with in the Monomoy school system, right?
I do QPR as well as mental health first aid, which is another suicide prevention course. It's longer. It's an 8-hour course, which really kind of starts with, and the youth portion of it really starts with What is adolescent development, and how do we look at these signs and symptoms in adolescents and really kind of think about, are those typical behaviors we're observing, or are they potential something that might be related to a mental health crisis leading up to a student or a youth? And when I say youth, you know, I'm talking about young from 10 up to, you know, 30. Mm-hmm. And I know 30 doesn't sound like a youth, but, you know, some of those signs and symptoms that we're looking at and some of the mental health crisis that might be a risk factor for suicide, we really kind of dive into deeply. So I do both of those trainings. I provide that to our staff in the district, as well as I have a grant through the Tower Foundation to provide it to community. So I also offer it within the Cape and Islands community. Mm-hmm. So which has been great. I offer at least probably 6 times a year. And if somebody asks for it, I will also be happy to put a course together for an organization. Yeah. And I just wanted to jump in really quick and just wanted to throw out there that there is a bill on the floor that is really looking to have a 3-digit number that is specific to suicide and mental health that one could dial, similar to 911. So there is a bill on the floor that they are looking to address that. So, because I've heard the concerns from folks that, you know, we can't remember all these numbers and, you know, the numbers mm-hmm. are long. And so this is hopefully a bill that will pass and will assist folks in remembering a 3-digit number versus some of the 800 numbers or some of the, you know, lengthier numbers. Yeah. I did want to just jump in on that.
Yeah, that would be very helpful, wouldn't it? Especially when you're in crisis, you're not really thinking clearly, and it'd be so much easier to have 3 numbers. Scott, anything else you want to add before about the group you work with before we look up? Go ahead.
Oh, you know me so well. So, Suicide offers programs for folks just 1 through 9. We work with all the schools on the Cape and in the region. And I also want to say that, you know, people can't learn everything about suicide prevention, but what you can remember is that if you're worried about a younger person and concerned about the pressures in their life, definitely watch the film Race to Nowhere. It's really helpful about understanding the pressure on young people. And I think if folks can think in all ages, all age spans, it's really important to understand that folks need several things. They need to have a meaningful role, connection to non-judgmental community, and an opportunity to contribute. This means someone who's an elder, someone who's in the hospital, can write cards, get real cards to other people near them. There's so many ways, if you think of those 3 things, how you can keep people healthier, but it's the lines of communication that change everything.
All right, Scott, thanks for calling in. Appreciate that. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point, and we are talking about suicide prevention this morning. With us is Lisa Forum. She's the Director of Risk Management at the Massachusetts Department of Mental Health and co-chair of the Cape and Islands Suicide Prevention Coalition. Melissa McGuire is the other co-chair of the Suicide Prevention Coalition. She's also the Director of Student Services in the Monomoy Regional District. John Murray, along with Maria Ventura, is founded Darkness into the Vineyard Light to raise awareness about suicide and encourage people to talk more openly about mental health. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Milo is calling us from Oak Bluffs. Good morning, Milo.
Hello there.
Hello. Go ahead.
I have 2 questions.
Sure.
The first question is, could it possibly, though rather perversely, be seen that suicide might be a sort of natural method whereby the human population is decreasing itself? Second question, are there any sociological or cultural factors that these 2 academics are pursuing as opposed to treating suicide as a disease on a case-to-case basis? I'll take my answer off the phone. Thank you.
All right, Milo, thanks for the call. Anybody have any thoughts on that?
I'd like to jump in.
Yes, go ahead.
Possible. I really want to bring it back to one of the questions we'd asked about in terms of removing stigma. I mean, the first thing that's really, really important for people to understand is that suicide is not just a mental health issue. Mm-hmm. So those are risk factors that are involved in suicide. And when we think about risk factors, you know, that's a risk factor. But we have, you know, abuse and trauma, and we have chemical imbalances, substance misuse, seasonal changes, ongoing stress and anxiety, medical conditions, you know, side effects of medication and illnesses that are life-threatening. And you know, are chronic or associated with pain and brain injury, and a list kind of goes on. In thinking about these risk factors and, you know, not just solely associating it with mental illness. So that's an important piece I think people need to understand. Mm-hmm. And with that, you know, you have all these protective factors that if we can really begin to shape and foster our protective factors, you know, that include healthy practices and problem-solving skills and people feeling in control of their life, spirituality, you know, parental, family, community support, economic security, you know, all of these pieces, community bonding, are so critical to really look at how do we minimize the risk factors and increase the protective factors for folks who are feeling in a place where they're hopeless, you know, or feel helpless, or they're in despair. And so I think those things are really important. And, of course, there's lots of economic and sociological factors that impact folks in terms of where they are in their life and how they are managing their life and how we as society are supporting individuals that are in that place to be able to have the services, support, strategies to really be able to move beyond or navigate those situations that they're struggling in that then make them feel hopeless.
Yeah.
So I hope that is, you know, provides a little bit of, you know, response to at least to those questions. And, you know, also for people to understand, and I believe Scott and Lisa and Stephanie have said it, when somebody is in, you know, a crisis, that it's important for that person to know they're not alone. And, you know, to approach it, as people have talked about, that you're never going to increase the probability of suicide if we're talking about, you know, someone thinking about suicide and being able to ask that question. I can tell you my father died by suicide, and I was very young, and knowing what I know now and understanding signs and symptoms, you know, I would have been in a much better place had I understood what my dad was going through, or if my mom had understood what he was going through, to possibly have prevented that. And for us in this day, it's all about educating, you know, making folks aware, really ensuring that we have those resources to provide that education and training.
Right, Lisa?
I couldn't agree more, and I'm so glad that you said that, Melissa. One of the things that we really want to talk about is the fact that suicide risk is not just attributed to people with a mental health diagnosis, but it's a community issue. Right now, the Department of Mental Health is pursuing an initiative called Zero Suicide, which is recognized as a best practice. And it's not just in the mental health community, but we're really bringing to the table healthcare providers and veteran services providers. But to look at, for example, if you go for your annual physical, is your doctor doing a screening for suicide or for suicide risk or for depression? We really want to make that be part of the whole health of an individual, because it isn't just people that have a diagnosis that could be at risk, but there could be a lot of factors involved in increasing someone's risk of suicide. So we really want to take away the stigma of it being just someone with a behavioral health issue and really recognizing that it's a community issue and that it's a whole health issue.
Right. I was just even thinking and listening to Melissa give some of those risk factors, and sometimes medication can, you know, side effects of medication can make you feel depressed, which could lead to where this person normally may never have those type of thoughts, right? Or trauma, some kind of huge trauma. You know, you lose a family member that's really close, and obviously you're going to be going through a grieving process. And there's so many different factors. It's really, I mean, there's a million risk factors, it seems like, right?
There are. And there are some risk factors that are static. We know that someone who has a history of trauma, or someone who has, we know that men are more likely to die by suicide than women's. So that's a static risk factor.
Do we know why?
Men tend to use more lethal means. Mm. And we can talk a little bit more about that a little bit later in terms of counseling on access to lethal means. But if you have a static risk factor and then you add in an illness that makes someone feel like they're a burden, if you talk about a loss of a job or a loss of financial security, a loss of a spouse, these dynamic risk factors then come in and play. And if we can mitigate those risks for the person, we may be able to save their life and help them realize that the permanent solution may not be the only choice, but we can have other solutions rather than just ending your life.
Right. In our region, what groups do we see at high risk for suicide? You mentioned men. And are there initiatives underway to reach those groups and the people who may come in contact with them?
Melissa can talk a little bit about youth suicide risk, but I can tell you that when I first began to do this work for the Department of Mental Health, we were having a cluster of suicides, particularly on Nantucket, and it was winter and it was middle-aged white trades workers. Mm. And so we actually organized just an outreach, and my boss and I went and hung out at the Marine Home Center where contractors go and where men are likely to be. And we went to Downey Flake Donuts where people have breakfast, and we just kind of pounded the pavement, and we went to the local garage, and we went to all the places where we thought that people might be willing to hear our information or at least hear our crisis phone line. And what we found was people were very eager to talk about things that they were worried about and things they were concerned about. So we really felt that just pounding the pavement and getting out there, just talking to people one-to-one, gave an opportunity to reduce the stigma and make it okay for people to ask for help. But again, that's, you know, we'll talk to home builders associations, mm-hmm. and we will talk to veterans groups and any place that we can find middle-aged white men.
Yeah.
We'll ask for them to come talk to us.
Melissa, some years ago, we saw a spike in teen suicide in our region, and we know rates of anxiety and depression in teens has been on the rise. What are some of the reasons we're seeing increased rates of depression and anxiety in teens?
Well, again, you know, really looking at all those risk factors, but, you know, I want to throw something out there that one of a real scary piece that came up and I addressed several times within our community is we saw a 28.9% increase in suicide following the 2017 13 Reasons Why Netflix series came out.
Ugh.
That was really scary. And I spent a lot of time, you know, communicating with parents, and we spent a lot of time communicating with students that what effect that that particular series had on our youth. And it was a series that basically where a girl died by suicide, and she had videos, 13 videos, and that each video was representing why one of her friends actually, you know, was the reason why she killed herself. And it was really scary, and I watched it because I wanted to understand what kids were seeing. And so when we look at kind of those influences that we have and really following all those risk factors, kids are very influential, and if we don't have those protective factors in place, we don't have that family support, and we don't have, you know, those routines in place, and we're not really paying attention to what students are doing and what our children are doing, youth, you know, these are all real critical pieces, and if they don't have trusted adults that they can go to, these are all factors, you know, that are important for, you know, a student or a youth mental and behavioral health.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are real, real critical pieces. But, you know, there's so many correlational pieces that go with, you know, students' increase of potential anxiety or depression or moving to that piece of you know, thinking about suicide. You know, the demands on our students. We have so many students who are working, going to school, juggling, you know, multiple, you know, expectations and demands simultaneously. We have a good portion of our students who are faced with economical challenges. You know, it's almost 50% of our families on the Cape and Islands, you know, who fall under our what's called free and reduced lunch.
Mm-hmm.
That adds, again, another risk factor and burden to a family and to a student when they're struggling to, you know, be able to eat breakfast in the morning or have the means to, you know, really move through their day in a healthy way.
Mm.
So those are really big pieces.
Yeah.
We're also, you know, as districts in the state of Mass, we, you know, we're required to provide suicide prevention training. So one of the things that we do in our schools is called SOS, Signs of Suicide. So we're providing that training to students because what we really want, and it's really effective because if it's see something, you say something. And so we have students who they're seeing in their friends risky behaviors, and they're coming in because they're concerned, and they're able to express those concerns to guidance counselors, our school site, and that was the intent of that program. We're also required, mandated to provide our staff with suicide prevention training as well. And that's where the mental health first aid comes in. And we also have the signs of suicide for educators that they are required to also take. So these are all things that we are trying to address in looking at our youth suicide. You know, we've seen a couple of spikes here and there. We saw a spike years back, I think it was 2012. That might be the wrong year, but, you know, where there was a real spike on Nantucket, where we had students who kind of consecutively died by suicide. We had several last year that we know of that died by suicide. And really looking at the different factors and some of these risk factors that we're looking at and how as a school community can we really provide the support and resources to families to better understand what we're seeing in our students. Yeah. We're really diving deep into social-emotional learning within our school districts on the Cape and Islands. It's become a main focus. It's one of our strategic priorities in our district strategic plan to really address the social-emotional behavioral health of students and how we integrate in those social-emotional learning skills across our curricula to ensure that they're developing those skills related to self-awareness, social awareness, and responsible decision-making and self-management and relationship skills. Those are all critical skills that will assist students, you know, as they mature and as they grow and develop into those protective factors, really giving them the tools to manage some of these demanding expectations that they're faced with.
Yeah. Lisa, according to bluehelp.org, since January 1st of 2016, there have been 25 law enforcement suicides in Massachusetts, and sadly, that makes the Commonwealth among the top 10 states nationwide for incidents of suicide among police officers. Suicide is the most significant cause of death among police. More officers die by suicide than in the line of duty, with at least 120 law enforcement suicides reported to date in 2019. How can we better identify officers at risk of suicide and get them the support and services?
There are really a lot of efforts to, again, the conversation we're having today is about reducing stigma and getting help. And one of our former steering committee members is a sergeant on Nantucket, police sergeant, Kevin Marshall. He does a lot of training on Cape Cod and the islands, teaching about crisis intervention so that police officers are aware of some mental health issues they might encounter in people that they're responding to. But also, he works really hard to encourage police officers to recognize their own signs of being at risk and seek help when it's necessary so that they aren't feeling like they can't ask for help because they're expected to be very strong and they're expected to be the helpers.
And also there's the idea of, well, gee, if I'm not, you know, if I'm seen as not being mentally strong, will that impact my progression up? You know, I want to be sergeant one day, or I want to move up the line, and that might have an impact on that. Right?
Absolutely. Yeah. There are so many professions that actually
feel that same way. Yeah.
Discourage people from getting help just because they might be questioned in their job about their fitness for duty.
Yeah.
There's a version of QPR actually that's directed for first responders and police officers and firefighters because they are witnessing a great deal of trauma
all the time.
Nothing happy happens in their jobs most of the time, and police officers in particular have access to lethal means.
Right. Statistics show that 90% of people show signs of suicide before the attempt. What are some of the signs we should be on the lookout for?
You definitely want to be familiar with, you know, just the static risk factors, as I mentioned, that there are certain, you know, that men could be at higher risk, but also some dynamic risk factors where someone might be experiencing a loss. They might have had some kind of trauma happen to them. They might have lost a spouse. And then from there, if you start to see that someone is maybe withdrawing a little bit, maybe talking a little bit about putting their affairs in order, maybe giving away some prized possessions, maybe thinking about... I actually had a woman who spoke to me the other day and said that she had a relationship with her father's veterinarian because her dad attempted suicide a number of times, and he would reach out to the veterinarian to say, can you put my dog down?
Oh, my. Wow.
Because he didn't want to leave the dog. And so the veterinarian knew to contact her and say, we're worried about your dad. So this is the reason why we talk so much about having a community of supports,
right?
So that we're really talking about looking out for each other and having everyone be aware of the signs and not being afraid to reach out if someone is showing some of them.
Yeah. So what are some of the actions we should take if we think someone is having suicidal thoughts?
Well, QPR will teach us to say, ask the question, mm-hmm. to really say, you know,
are you thinking about this?
I'm really seeing some signs in you, and you've been through a lot lately, and I'm wondering if you're thinking about ending your life. Just go right out there and ask the question. And the research shows us that most of the time people are very relieved to have someone ask.
We're talking about suicide prevention and awareness. 866-999-4626 is our number. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about suicide prevention and awareness. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. With us is Lisa Foran. She's the Director of Risk Management at the Massachusetts Department of Mental Health and co-chair of the Cape and Islands Suicide Prevention Coalition. Melissa McGuire is the other co-chair of the Suicide Prevention Coalition and Director of Student Services in the Monomoy Regional School District. John Murray is a co-founder of Darkness Into the Vineyard Light, which raises awareness about suicide and encourages people to talk more openly about mental health. So, John, we were mentioning you had the first event last year. So what was your experience like with the Darkness Into Vineyard Light event last year? And what did people tell you about the experience of sharing their stories?
My first experience was in Ireland, actually, and watching families come in and walking and talking about listening to conversations, which really you shouldn't do, but walking with families by myself and listening to them talk about their loss was a wonderful experience. They talked about how good a life the person had, how they missed the signs of what was going on the vineyard. I was in Stop and Shop in Egerton last week, and I asked the lady who I saw. I was at the event last year, and I said, "Hey, are you going to come again this year?" And she said, "No, I guess I am. I wouldn't want to miss it." She says, "You know, I lost my brother 5 years ago, and I've never been able to talk about it until last year. When the walk was the first time I could talk about it, and I've been able to talk about it since." So that's what we want to be able to get people to be able to talk about it, to bring more awareness to the issues with mental health, and to take away the stigma of it. It's important that we celebrate the loss. We celebrate our friends that we've lost, but also learn from their experience and share that experience with other people. And I find that the community really wants to do something. People really want to take part in something, even in a small way, you know, contributing a little bit to raising funds for the help with the crisis center and the vineyard. This year we're working with NAMI, National Alliance for Mental Health. And so we're encouraging people to come out and join us.
When's the walk?
The walk's on Saturday morning, 5 a.m. We assemble at Bend in the Road. Parking is down by the triangle. There'll be lots of volunteers to direct people. It'll be in the dark, so bring flashlights. We will have breakfast. We will have coffee and all those other things. We have some speakers. Mm-hmm. We'll have music. Some of the mini singers from the high school are coming. There's a lot of kids coming from the high school. So we had an issue this year there, an event that happened. So we encourage you to come down. We have pre-registration for this evening at 3 to 5, and tomorrow afternoon 3 to 5 at the Triangle in Egerton outside Depot 2539. And I encourage you to do pre-registration rather than come down in the middle, of the night to try and sign up.
Right. So. Lisa, I mean, that's another struggle when we talk about the families of, who've lost a loved one to suicide. As John's saying, that's not uncommon for somebody to say, "I haven't been able to talk about it."
Yeah, we hear that quite a bit. And again, I'm always really stunned when we do some kind of awareness event or we put up a booth at, some kind of public gathering, and people are just not afraid to come and talk to us and tell their stories. But in particular, we do worry about those who have experienced a loss, a suicide loss in their family or a loved one, and that can potentially increase their loss. I know that the Samaritans does a support group for people who have experienced suicide loss. But we definitely, again, want to make this be an issue that the community can respond to and people don't feel alone and isolated.
Yeah, they're getting rid of that stigma, as you were talking about.
Getting rid of that stigma, exactly.
So if a survivor of suicide makes it to a hospital as a result of his or her attempt, is behavioral health referral made right then? And is there any follow-up or tracking of these individuals? I mean, does confidentiality prevent family members from being informed? What's the process?
Confidentiality is always a concern, and certainly you want to respect someone's privacy and respect what they feel is right for their own treatment. Yes, if someone does arrive at a hospital with injuries related to a suicide attempt, they will certainly be evaluated and, if warranted, hospitalized for psychiatric treatment after the attempt. What our Zero Suicide Initiative actually is working on is a couple of different areas, which is, first and foremost, not making seeking mental health treatment be punitive, because it is not unusual for people to avoid asking for help because they're afraid they might be committed to a hospital against their will. Mm-hmm. And that may not necessarily be the only option for treatment for them. In addition, we really want to make sure that when someone is hospitalized psychiatrically after a suicide attempt, that when they're discharged from the hospital and between that time and the next time that they have an appointment with an outpatient provider, that they have an opportunity to have someone be in touch with them because they can still be at risk. Mm-hmm. And so we've partnered as part of the Zero Suicide Initiative with the Samaritans. And if someone is leaving our hospital in Pocasset, if someone's willing to have that warm handoff, we'll arrange it for them, and we'll even make the initial phone call to the Samaritans for them, and the Samaritans will continue to reach out to them until they are safe, as long as they feel like they need it, but certainly up until their next provider appointment, to make sure that they're getting the treatment they need, that they're willing to accept help, and minimize the risk of suicide after the hospitalization.
What do suicide loss survivors tell you about what's the best way to approach someone who's experienced that loss?
The coalition primarily works with suicide prevention, but loss survivors will say that, again, they feel ashamed or isolated. They feel as though they are alone in the grief that they're experiencing. And I think with any other human who's experiencing something difficult in their lives, just having someone who makes himself available to listen is certainly a help.
Yeah. Melissa, do you see that teens are more willing to talk about their feelings, be it anxiety, depression, feelings, you know, of self-harm, as schools put more emphasis on talking about behavioral health?
I think what we are seeing is definitely an increase in students' ability to express their feelings. You know, we spend a lot of time really looking at, you know, again, developing the social-emotional learning skills, you know, around self-awareness and self-management relationship skills. And recently, we're going into our third year of providing an anonymous survey, so to speak, from our grades 3 to 12, which is a social-emotional learning survey, and it's self-perception on, you know, how I think I'm doing and, you know, am I able to handle demands and stresses and anxiety? Do I have a trusted adult that I can go to if I'm in crisis? And the responses have been fantastic in terms of I had 1,100 responses in our school district to this particular survey. And what we're using that for is opportunities to sit with students and develop some personal goals around, you know, what are the issues that are preventing them from succeeding or are really interfering with their ability to be successful in school and out in the community. So we're seeing kids become more self-aware and able to speak with a trusted adult, which is such a huge, huge protective factor to have that, you know, trusted person to go to. So we really work hard on that, as I know many of the other schools on the Cape and Islands do as well. So we're really appreciating that and them being able to express how they're actually feeling, you know, when they're really stressed out or overwhelmed or, you know, just really not able to manage what's happening. And the critical piece is, what do we do with that? Mm-hmm. You know, how do we kind of shift that for them and make sure that you know, they have the time they need to be able to reengage with their learning? And what I'm always, you know, talking about in the course I teach is, if kids are not, you know, mentally prepared, you know, mentally healthy in the moment, they're not ready for learning. And so we really have to, you know, focus on that as a school and as a community. And then just going, just to kind of dovetail on what Lisa was talking about, when someone is approaching you in the conversation you had, and if you, you know, listen to Lisa's words, she used a lot of I statements. We're really making sure that we're not using accusatory statements, you know, by starting with, you know, you're doing X, Y, and Z. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we've noticed this and we're really concerned, or I'm really concerned about you, so I want to be able to provide you with the support you need. And the most critical part of that for youth and adults is being present in the moment. We as a community and as human beings need to slow down. We need to, you know, be able to be present with somebody when they're expressing concern about their mental wellness. We need to stop looking at our watch and stop looking at our phones, and we need to provide that, you know, in the moment presence of listening and not judging and, you know, providing that eye contact. And it's so critical that, and that's for everybody. We need to slow down and listen and pay attention to who's in front of us.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if this is a question for Melissa or Lisa, but how early should we start talking to kids about feelings of despair or self-harm?
That's definitely a question for Melissa.
Yeah, we start, in all honesty, you know, our social-emotional learning is pre-K through 12. So, and when I say that, you know, we're implementing lessons at our preschool level that really start addressing that self-awareness piece. And with that self-awareness, you know, we're talking about recognizing, you know, strengths, identifying emotions, understanding self-perception, you know, self-efficacy. We really move along kind of that spectrum of skills with students, you know, from pre-K to grades 12. In the middle school, of course, we're having deeper conversations about that as children, you know, develop and adolescents develop. And, you know, we know the brain continues to develop right up into the mid-20s before it's fully formed and able to, quite frankly, manage everything that is thrown at them. So we do have those conversations at young ages. We've had very, very young children express thoughts of harming themselves or express thoughts of killing themselves. And it, so it is alarming. So we are really paying attention and delivering curriculum that is hopefully giving them the skills and strategies to begin to better manage, you know, where those pockets of you know, crisis might be forming for them, mm-hmm. and being able to really communicate that. So it's a very young age.
Yeah. Lisa,
we're also doing, our task is also to provide, you know, substance abuse curriculum, mm-hmm. so that we're really diving into that. And quite frankly, at grade three, we're implementing BOTS and life skills, which is an anti-addiction curriculum. So we're doing that right up to grade 12 as well. Mm-hmm. So those are all pieces that we see are interfering with students' access to their learning.
Yeah. Sounds like we're doing a lot in the schools, which is a good thing. So, Lisa, I just want to really quickly, in the last minute or so, we have touch on support groups. It seems that women seem to be more willing to show up in the support groups than men. And that's probably part of the reason why you go out to these places where you find men, right? Has that been your experience as well?
Yeah, I'm not particularly involved in support groups. However, I can tell you that there is a group called Mass Men, massmen.org, that are particularly bringing together groups of men to ask them what kind of suicide prevention efforts make sense for them, because it's different for everyone. But I do think that you have to go where people are. And if we've identified this particular group, we got to find them.
Mm-hmm. Whoever they are.
Whoever right. they are, exactly.
Yeah. And so I guess our big message is here, don't be afraid to talk about it.
Absolutely.
Ask the question and don't be afraid to talk about
it. In the same way that you might say, I've got the flu or I'm not feeling well. Not feeling well is not different if you're thinking about despair.
Right. We're going to post links with more information about suicide prevention and education, the crisis hotline numbers, and the Darkness into Vineyard Light event taking place this Saturday at our website, capeandislands.org. Lisa Ferrain and Melissa McGuire, co-chairs of the Cape and Islands Suicide Prevention Coalition, John Murray, co-founder of Darkness into the Vineyard Light. Thank you all for talking with us today and for the work that you're doing. We really appreciate that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.